Chromosomes. Little strands of nucleic acids and proteins are the fundamental genetic instructions that tell us who we are at birth. Most people are born with 46 chromosomes, but each year in the United States, about 6,000 people are born with an extra chromosome, making them a person with Down syndrome. If you've ever encountered someone with Down syndrome, you know that they are some of the kindest, most joyful people you will ever meet. They truly have something extra. My name is Lisa Nichols, and I have spent the last 24 years as both the CEO of Technology Partners and as the mother to Allie. Allie has something extra in every sense of the word. I have been blessed to be by her side as she impacts everyone she meets. Through these two important roles as CEO and mother to Allie, I have witnessed countless life lessons that have fundamentally changed the way I look at the world. While you may not have an extra chromosome, every leader has something extra that defines who you are. Join me as I explore the something extra in leaders from all walks of life and discover how that difference in each of them has made a difference in their companies, their families, their communities, and in themselves. I am excited to welcome Krister Ungerbach to the show today. Krister is a former CEO turned author, speaker, and expert on the language of leadership. Krister, I am so excited to have you here today. You and I haven't really known each other that long. We met probably 2 months ago, 3 months ago at an AIM leadership conference, and you were one of the keynotes. So then we connected after that, and I'm just so excited to have you on the show today and excited for our listeners to learn more about you and what you do.
I'm excited to be here. Well, we share a lot of the same values as leaders, so it's always good to connect with people who share similar values.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. There's a lot that I want to talk about, so let's just dive on in. Can you give us just a very quick version of your growing up?
Probably one of the more impactful parts of my upbringing was I skipped the third grade, which was, I say, was one of the best and worst things that ever happened to me, because I was one, you get the what psychologists call the halo effect, that like teachers are like, hey, that's the kid who skipped the third grade.
Right.
So, you know, I didn't have to work as hard to get good grades.
Right.
But on the negative side, I was like bullied as a kid. I didn't have any friends for like a period of like, you know, 5 or 10 years. So I was really introverted, so much so that when I went to college, I was looking at going to MIT and I decided to go to Indiana University because I was like, I need to go and develop a personality. And I came back after my first year, and I remember my mother saying to me, she said, since when did you become such an extrovert? And so I kind of purposely went to college saying, I need to be less of a nerd.
Right.
And I was kind of a computer geek, you know, learned programming at age 12.
Well, and I know that you started with Booz Allen.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. I think at the time you were the youngest associate. You were 20 years old when you started there.
My original goal was actually one of the first business books I ever read was when I was probably 15 or 14 years old. I read Tom Peters' In Search of Excellence.
I read that book too. Great
and
book.
And he, in the back, he was McKinsey. And so I was like, oh, what's this McKinsey? And so my goal since that time was to work for McKinsey. So I went to Indiana and I had pretty good grades. You know, the halo effect had worn off because now his college was big enough. And I wanted to go work for McKinsey, and I chased him down and hounded him. And finally, I escalated to a partner and said, hey, you know, I've gotten 3 letters saying that you won't even interview me. And in the end, they said, well, we're not going to interview you. And gave me a bunch of reasons that were actually why they should interview me. And I said, hold on, you haven't really given me a reason why you wouldn't. And he said, you know what? You were just too aggressive in pursuing
in
a job with Booz Allen,
with
McKinsey.
But you knew what you wanted, you know, and you went after it.
And realistically, I think that, you know, McKinsey at those days, they weren't hiring people from Indiana University and hiring a 20-year-old kid to go charge $500 an hour probably was not aligned with the brand.
Right. So. Well, Booz Allen has a wonderful reputation, too. Yes. So that was a great
place
for you
spot.
To start. Yeah. Exactly. What in the world were you thinking at 15 years old when you were reading Tom Peters' book? I mean, where was it in your environment? Was it your parents that really inspired you? Was it a teacher, a coach? I mean, where did you get that? Because, I mean, most 15-year-olds are not reading business books.
Growing up in an entrepreneurial family, my father being a CEO, I think that he always wanted us to, myself and all my brothers, to follow in his footsteps in the business. So For many years, I always knew that I was going to be an entrepreneur and I was going to run a business. In my 17th birthday, actually, I read The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. And it said, write your personal mission statement. And that's actually something that was kind of a turning point, a moment in my life at that time. I took 3 days and I went and wrote my personal mission statement. And it was to teach, to learn from, and to inspire people to achieve that which they never thought possible. And my lifetime goal was to build one $1 billion company in my life. Admittedly, this goal like just defined me.
It was my identity. Was your driver.
And fortunately,
I love that mission statement though. Yeah. I love that. That's perfect.
So fortunately, I had a backup mission statement or a backup goal because, you know, we'll get to it, I'm sure, in a little bit, the time of letting go of that vision that was my identity. The second one was really more like he also encourages you to not just have a professional goal, but have something that's more broad-reaching. Mm-hmm. And it was to live my life as if somebody might write a book about me one day. And not from an egotistical standpoint, but more as a kind of a guiding principle for mm-hmm. life, right? So if I wake up in the morning and say, what am I going to do today that's going to be something worth writing about? Mm-hmm. And also as an accountability, like, did I do something today that I wouldn't want written in a book about me
right.
someday?
That's a great way to live.
Fortunately, now that the building a billion-dollar company is no longer part of my identity, I have a fallback. And mm-hmm. So I'm working on that book. So no one else is going to write it about me, so I'll write it.
I'll write it myself. That's awesome. So you're at Booz Allen, but your mom and dad had founded Ungerbach Software.
Yes.
Right? And if you are a St. Louisan, you may see their big LED sign on 40. So talk to us about that journey. It was, I believe, and I'm not going to put words in your mouth, but the business was struggling a little bit, I believe, and your dad had asked you to possibly step in.
I worked in the business when I was young, and I worked in the summer, starting at age 12, mm-hmm. programming. And then there was a summer in college that I worked there, and my father fired me. We had a technical disagreement. Uh-huh. I was 17 at the time, and we were building our first version of the software for PCs, a client mm-hmm. server, as Becker mm-hmm. was called in those days. And he wanted me to do something that was honestly technically impossible until about 15 years later. And I had already talked to the engineers at IBM and the research lab, and I was like, this is just not possible. Mm-hmm. And he continued kind of the Steve Jobs, the reality distortion field, but just make it happen. You know? And so after some number of weeks or months of attempting to convince him, he fired me. And mm-hmm. I said, okay, that's fine. But I'll never come to work for the business again. And that was kind of what was really clear to me, that my father and I couldn't work together. And so I graduated from college, went to Booz Allen, and I also worked for a small startup consulting firm. And coincidentally, about 3 weeks before his birthday in 1997, he called me up and said, hey, we got this big project in Hong Kong, and if you don't quit your job and come run this project, then I'm afraid that we're going to be in a lawsuit with a court of jurisdiction in Hong Kong, which probably is not going to play out for us.
Not a good place to be.
He said it was an offer that I couldn't refuse. So I went and quit my job and moved to St. Louis. And we started at that time, the company, I was the 14th employee. We're kind of, roughly breaking even. Interestingly, I was, as a 24, 25-year-old kid, I was making more money than my parents together. So obviously that's not a great situation
right.
to be in.
Right.
If you're in your 40s and 50s. And you have 4 kids, in large part because of this Hong Kong project that mm-hmm. They had sold before I came, and mm-hmm. we made it successful. That was kind of the turning point in the company. Since then, we've been on a road that we grew 3,000% since then, and we're hundreds 3, of employees worldwide.
And, yes. And how many countries?
Employees in 8 or 9 countries, mm-hmm. and then customers in, 40, 50 mm-hmm. countries. I mean, it keeps going up. So
let's back up for 1 minute. And for our listeners who don't know what Ungerbach does, tell them what Ungerbach does.
Probably the simplest way is we're like SAP for the events business. We're like the one all-in-one solution that somebody who does events as their kind of large portion of their business. Mm-hmm. We're the kind of CRM through financial solution for those kind of niche businesses. So obviously there's modules that people can say, I only want this part.
Right.
I already use SAP for my financials.
Right.
I already use Salesforce for mm-hmm. CRM, but then they just use the event pieces. Mm-hmm. But that's, in a nutshell, mm-hmm. what we do.
It's a very niche market,
yes,
I would say. Yeah.
And also because the events industry is very international, that's what's taken us easily
into other countries.
Mm-hmm. Many industries, it's very difficult mm-hmm. to go international like that. The events mm-hmm. and tourism industry, because it is about going other places, all other things equal, makes it a little bit easier.
So talk to us a little bit. How long were you at Ungerbach? And you had amazing success. In fact, I said, you know, one of the things that you say, you charted topping employee engagement ratings at 99.3% and won 5 top place awards 5 times in a row.
Yep.
And I'm thinking our listeners are going to say, how did you do that? Everybody wants to know, how can I increase employee engagement? That's on the top of everybody's list.
Well, especially in tech, I used to say that if you want to win the war for customers, the first step is to win the war for talent. Because if you win the war for talent, then the customers will come. It's not just about the build it and they will come kind of strategy. If you've got the best marketing people and the best salespeople and the best service people and the best software developers, then put a magical team together. And then more importantly, keep them together for a long period of time.
It's not just attract them, but retain them. So how did you do that? How did you get a 99.3% employee engagement?
So I think the first is just, how do we measure that? So we did the top workplace studies, and I picked out one question that I thought was kind of indicative of employee engagement, which was, I would like to be working for this company 1 year from today. And we would just look at what's the agrees versus disagrees, and we looked at some other kind of ways. The last year before I left was actually, I was shocked when we like ran the numbers that 99.3% of the people agreed. And we have, you know, we have pretty broad participation. And so it wasn't that we just like sent the survey out to, you know, the people who we thought would agree. Which means every single employee except one agreed with that statement, either strongly agree or agree. The interesting thing, you know, they say people don't leave jobs, they leave bosses. At that time, I also asked, well, so who's the one employee who said that they disagree?
Sure.
And interestingly, that person for many years had reported to me. So I was that person's boss, at least the person that probably created the negative environment.
Right.
And I won't take full responsibility because the person was admittedly somewhat toxic, and I wasn't the only person who was not a huge fan of that person.
Right.
But that
did cause you to do some self-reflection, I'm sure.
Yeah, I think that was probably the one thing that as a leader that I was always very open to, what am I doing wrong? And whenever something was going wrong, I was always first saying, okay, how could I have done this differently? You know, if an employee was not performing, my first thought was,
wasn't
I clear?
Them?
You know, did I set clear objectives?
Yes.
How is it my own language and behavior contributed to this breakdown? In any case, so the creating the employee engagement, I think for me, I used to always say that from the beginning is that smart people like to work with smart people. So I think that a big part of it is creating a brand of companies, you know, a company that people are like, this is where I am dying to work. And it kind of goes a little bit back to that McKinsey thing. I remember when I was, you know, 15, I read this book. And then said, you know, 1 out of 10,000 applicants actually gets a job there or something like that. You know, so creating a brand where people, you know, say, wow, this is like, I would hope to work here. And then you need to follow it up with a place that people really do want to work. So having people that really where the people go there and they say, you know, I really appreciate that I'm learning from everyone
I'm
work with or most of the people I work with. So I'm growing, that there's just not a lot of drama. I think that the other part of building that kind of employee engagement culture is the hiring process is critical. In the early days, so like in that 1997 to kind of 2001, we had a lot of people that just weren't working out, right? You know, we were growing 100% a year, and I just need somebody. I need a body.
You need a body.
You know? And so we kind
of
took our lessons.
So you got more intentional with your hiring?
Yeah. So it's better to go without someone than to hire the wrong person. And it took us a long time to really develop that discipline. I think the other thing that was really big for me was that, and this is interesting, when I was in Germany, I moved to Germany to open our businesses in France and Germany. If somebody would go to like the monster.com of Germany, which I think was at the time called jobpilot.de, they would submit their resume. And because of the way most German companies work, it would be like 3 weeks before the company would respond. But in the U.S. and around the world, our belief was always that, like, the best people, I mean, they're going to get snapped
up
immediately.
They're going to get snapped up. Right.
So,
that's right. So you better respond quickly.
Yeah. And so we would try to differentiate ourselves. Like, how can I set up a process where if I see a good candidate that they get a call back within, like, 30 minutes from submitting their job? And then the other part was even more so, how can we get those candidates like really unique access. So For example, I remember one case, there was a, I personally felt my job was to be like the chief recruiting officer as CEO.
Yes.
There was one person, it was a critical hire globally that we were looking for. And I remember this person submitted the resume, and we were 200 person company at the mm-hmm. time. So it's mm-hmm. not like I was literally getting all these emails in my inbox. There was a time when I was.
Right.
But we were able to actually call him like at 5:30 p.m. German time. And he was literally surprised. It was hours after he had submitted his mm-hmm. resume. Mm-hmm. And he was literally like, who is this? And like, and I said, well, this is Christer Ungerbach. So not only was he surprised as a German getting a call 3 hours after submitting his resume, but he was equally surprised that he was getting a call from the CEO, mm-hmm. right? So it was really flipping that. If you've got that one out of 500 people that you want to hire, don't have the assistant HR recruiter at the bottom of the organization
calling that
like
person.
How can you get them to mm-hmm. the vice president or the CEO or mm-hmm. high up to where they're like, I can't even believe
right.
I'm talking. And then of course we couldn't pull that off all the time, but then mm-hmm. we would also have things that we would do, like if our HR team and recruiting team would know that if I'm in a meeting and if they're walking a job candidate around the building, mm-hmm. giving them a tour for their first or second interview, and would they know that we're in like a competitive situation and this is somebody that we really want to impress,
mm-hmm.
they would kind of knock on the door. And the knock on the door
yes.
was the signal that I knew that, okay, you know, so I would, you know, assuming it was a meeting, I could kind of wrap up, but, you know, I'd wrap it up, invite them in. You know, the playbook was written such that the HR people would then say, yeah, wow, is that the first CEO you've met at any of the companies that you've been to make sure that, so it was really kind of being purposeful. But then again, all these things need to be followed up. Like, mm-hmm. you know, if people then couldn't come into my office on a moment's notice after they were hired, then it would be kind of inconsistent. Mm-hmm. So, you know.
Yeah, that's so important. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back with Christer. Hi, everybody. I just wanted to take a second and tell you about something our team at Technology Partners can do for your business. We have spent over 2 decades partnering with organizations and helping them solve their IT needs from a 360-degree perspective. A huge part of how we solve those needs is by developing custom applications of all shapes and sizes. If your team is looking for software and an out-of-the-box solution just isn't right, it's time to consider how we might be able to help. Go to tpi.co/custom apps and learn more about our awesome capabilities. Christer, so you did all of that, but then something drove you to retire at the age of 42.
Yeah.
So let's talk about that story.
So as I said, I had kind of this, you know, my father fired me at age 17, and this was kind of this conflict was ever present in our kind of business relationship. And so at age 42, I say that I kind of went through simultaneously a business divorce and decided that the time had come. There are many, many times over the years that I'd considered leaving the company. Over the last kind of 18 months, I started building a team that I felt that the company could be equally successful without mm-hmm. me, and preparing for the possibility of initially going to the owners and saying, hey, mm-hmm. this conflict needs to end, and like, I'll buy the company. And then we'll go forward. But I knew that if I was going to put that offer on the table and make it real, that it was going to be a parting of the ways moment if we couldn't come to an agreement.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that also my duty to our employees was that if I was going to go down that path, mm-hmm. that I needed to make sure that I left a legacy of a company that would be equally successful without me. Otherwise, and this was probably 10 years prior, I'd had a equally kind of turning point moment that ultimately resulted in my father retiring and me becoming CEO. But at that time, I knew that if I left, I wouldn't be putting our employees in a situation
the
that the company
situation.
Would be equally mm-hmm. successful. So the net of it is we couldn't come to an agreement on that buyout. So I said, you know, it's time for me to move on.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
and I've hired a team of somebody who I think can run the company equally well. And fortunately, now it's 3-4 years later, the company has been performing equally mm-hmm. well. And grown, achieved similar revenue growth and also increased profit margins over the last 3 years. So I'm happy. The business outcome is good. The hardest part for me was that I walked out on this vision of building a billion-dollar company. So 6 months before that moment, I had kind of stood in front of our customers and we did on video and said that, you know, I kind of shifted the vision from building a billion-dollar company to building a billion-dollar company, but with the intention of sharing the financial fruits of that with our employees to create 500 employee millionaires.
Mm.
And so it was really because that my family is not overly money motivated. I'm mm-hmm. not personally overly money motivated. And realistically, we have a business that's valued at probably more than our wildest dreams today. There was an opportunity to share all the extra, right? Mm-hmm. All the something extra, right. You know, because there was a lot of something extra, yeah. potential something extra yes. to go around. But when it became clear that I didn't see that I was going to be able to have the control to bring that vision to life, that I felt it was time to move on. But walking away was walking away from this mm-hmm. defining vision that I'd created at age 19. Mm-hmm. So it was really like walking out of my identity. So I say I walked out on the CEO job that I love, and then 2 weeks later, my wife walked out on me. So I was nothing.
No right? identity.
It was in March, 3 or 4 years ago, and I remember I was at the YMCA signing up for a gym membership. The woman asked me, "Who is your emergency contact?" And I broke down crying because I didn't have someone yeah. off the top of my head. Mm-hmm. I was like, you know, not my father, not my wife. And it became clear to me that we had built this great business, but I was a leader with no followers, right? So I'd started reading these business books at age, you know, whatever.
15.
Yeah. I sometimes wonder if it was earlier than that, but whatever it was is I started reading the business books and all these things that had led to being a successful leader of a business, yet I felt that I was a failure as a leader of people. And admittedly, I think that a lot of the employee engagement and things like that, I think that some of the people who reported to me, you know, like Steve Jobs was a good example, mm-hmm. like where people were like, he was really kind of a jerk, right? Mm-hmm. For most of his, right. for a large portion of his career. But what I'm convinced is somewhat similar to them. He's like, the next layer of people below can
more
insulate.
More people.
You know,
yes,
you can have a really toxic boss. Many people who worked for me wouldn't say, hey, you are not a toxic boss.
Yes.
But I certainly had my big jerk days.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that there's some level of, you know, if we do have toxic leaders, then the next layer down can really be the insulation
right.
to insulate. And I believe that based on some of the reading and things I've done is that's a large part of what happened many years at Apple when Steve Jobs was that person firing in elevators. The challenge in tech is that we read Steve Jobs, you know, biography, and after that came out, people were like, oh, well, young founder, startup CEOs were like, oh, that's why I'm kind of really tough because
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's what made Steve Jobs successful. But in any case, I looked at myself and I said, what was I missing? And so I went on kind of this 3-year journey really looking for what I felt was that my heart was in the right place. Mm-hmm. But what I learned is that my words were not. So being an engineer, emotional intelligence was just not something that really kind of
came. Not in your
vocabulary. Yeah, it was not. But despite reading Daniel Goleman's book about emotional intelligence
sure.
in 1997, I was like, you know, I knew intellectually what emotional intelligence was all about. And I knew that I wanted to be better at emotional
mm-hmm.
intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
I knew it was a weakness
of
mine.
So your heart was there.
Yeah. But the challenge is
I
never could crack the code.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until I discovered that it was the words that I was using. It was just how I was speaking. And because I'm an engineer and I'm fairly analytical, like I want recipes, right? You know, fill
mm-hmm.
in the blanks. And this is kind
mm-hmm.
of what I discovered over this journey is what I call the language of leadership is it's simple fill-in-the-blanks phrases and say this, not that rules for leading more powerfully, but also with empathy. It's for balancing kind of toughness with kindness, results with relationships,
mm-hmm.
you know, and analytical intellect with emotions, right? Because this is something I just never really did very well.
Mm-hmm.
I was very good at being tough. I was very good at being analytical.
Yes.
And I was very good at the results part.
Mm-hmm.
But it was the relationships and the kindness and some of the other things.
So that is where the language of leadership came from.
This is what it was, yeah.
Yes.
And a big part was also informed through the shortly after September 11th, I moved to Europe to start our businesses in France and Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And so once I started to learn how different words could shift, and sometimes they're very subtle shifts in words, can shift kind of a whole relationship and interaction.
Mm.
I kind of look back at when I moved to Europe in 2001, I had to learn French and German from nothing and learn to lead and do business in
right.
these languages. And so I hired some of the best French and German business teachers, and they helped me with these shortcuts for learning French.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So a lot of this kind of how to teach people this new language of leadership is built on kind of like how did this, Jean-Luc was his name, how did he teach me business French in kind of a shorthand way,
wow.
which really
mm-hmm.
came down to memorize how to say it this way, you know,
mm-hmm.
fill in the blanks phrases,
mm-hmm.
simple, don't say this, say that. And I think that for me is kind of how I went from never having anyone ever saying, hey, you're empathetic or emotionally intelligent to, you know, now 3 years on, actually, it's something that I do get actually
complimented on. So that is so, I love that. Because I always say, you know, even if you are weak in an area, if you've got the right growth mindset, you can change those things. You can move the needle on those things. And clearly, you're an example of that. You're
an
example
of that.
We can grow,
but we also need the tools, right?
Yes, you need the tools.
This emotional intelligence thing for me was I read tons of books on it, but I never found the right practical tools. You know, even if you Google today, how do I improve my emotional intelligence? There's still not like
a
really concrete
out there.
Of how to do it. And for me, it was simple, like just change our words.
Language.
Like three to five different simple language changes we can make.
I love that. Well, we could talk about that all day long. Yeah. I love that. You know, I do want to talk about something extra. Tell us about something extra that was missing in you.
Yeah.
And you've already alluded to it, but go ahead and restate.
For me, the something extra is just the words, the language. You know, so what was in my heart was not matching what was in my words. And it wasn't until I kind of went on this 3-year journey talking to, what I purposely did is I set aside all the business books. I was like, I'm not going to read any business book, you know, even closely, you know. And I went off on this journey talking to people who are kind of admittedly somewhat far out, weird, but I always had my CEO business hat on. Like, how can I translate their words? In fact, I'm planning a conference for next year in Boston. And a lot of these people I'm trying to bring in. But what I realize is that the challenge that I have is that some of these people have great, great concepts. But when you sit in front of a group of business leaders and you talk about the universe and, you know, new age concepts like that, like people just check out. They're in the bathrooms and, you know, checking their phone.
Yeah.
So a lot of it is helping these individuals. And that's part of what the language of leadership is about, is taking some of these concepts that were kind of new age and frankly a little out there, taking away all the new age and maybe not as useful stuff and translating it into words that business people can really get value from.
Very good. What do you believe is the something extra that every leader needs?
I think it is the simple rules of how we can speak with more emotional intelligence and empathy. And what I always struggled with, the day that I learned that I was maybe a jerk was actually in about 2011.
Okay.
I did a 360 survey and discovered I was tougher than I thought I was. And so for 5 or 6 years, I was trying to develop this, how can I be more emotionally intelligent? But I never, honestly, I mean, we still achieve good results, you know, 15 to 20% growth, you know, so I never felt like I really cracked the code of how to get balance toughness with kindness until after I retired and really said, hey, I want to figure this out.
And now, and you did the hard work, and that's hard work to do what you did and take that time. And you're doing a lot of self-reflection. And like you said, you kind of went on this cracking the code mission, if you will.
Yeah.
That's hard work, but certainly that's paid off. So do you have something that is coming up that you want our listening audience to know about?
Well, so the one thing that's coming up for people who are in St. Louis or near St. Louis is on August 20th at the Two Hill Performing Arts Center at UMSL, I'll be giving the first ever Language of Leadership experience. We're going to have tickets, should be on sale by the time the podcast airs.
Great.
But people can go to thelanguageofleadershipexperience.com or they can come to my website, krister.com, and buy tickets for that. So there I'll be sharing some of the actual tools for how to speak with the language of leadership.
Absolutely. Well, so if you are out there in our listening audience and this is resonating with you, I would highly encourage you to go and hear Krister. He's a phenomenal speaker, and I know that it'll be time worthwhile. So thank you so much for being here today, Chris.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Our show today is executive produced by Brian Muncy. Our technical producer is Daniel Williams. Something Extra with Lisa Nichols is a Technology Partners production. Copyright Technology Partners, Inc. 2019. For show notes or to reach out to Lisa, visit tpi.co/podcast. Don't forget to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you listen.